I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. A few weeks ago, in front of a packed house at WHYY in Philadelphia, we recorded live on stage with three of the best chefs in the city. And so this week, we're bringing you our Philly special. Now, between the Eagles winning the Super Bowl and Villanova just roasting my Michigan Wolverines, Philadelphia is just unstoppable these days. But, you know, a lot of people in the food world have known that for a while now. I mean, it's home of the greatest hoagies and cannoli on earth, and fantastic Vietnamese and Mexican food, and a little gem called the roast pork sandwich. But it's only lately that people outside of Philly have started to see it as a home of great chef talent. So we wanted to talk to three of the chefs who are at the forefront of the scene: Michael Solomonov of Zahav, Eli Culp of High Street, and Angie Branca of Saute Campar. And it turns out that none of those chefs were originally from Philadelphia, but they all chose to make their careers and lives there. So we talked with them about what inspires them and how they root themselves in their city, and really, what is it about this town that makes it so delicious? Our first guest definitely had some thoughts. So Mike Solomonov, you are the chef owner of Zahav, and you are known literally around the world as one of the great voices of Israeli cooking, of Israeli-American cooking. People treat you like an ambassador. You know, they call you up when they want to know something about a place that's 6,000 miles from here. But I want to talk to you about something that's a little closer. And the fact that I read an article about you, and in it it said that you, you know, are constantly turning down offers to open Zahav's elsewhere. And the reason you gave was, making money sounds great, but I like when people come to Philadelphia to have dinner.
True story.
What does that mean?
Well, we here in Philly, we are often overshadowed, or have been overshadowed in the past, from DC and New York. And I love being in the restaurant. I love cooking in the restaurant. I love greeting people. I love the fact that we have people that will travel to Philly to have dinner. And I think that that is such a switch. You know, I think that at one point, if you wanted to cook, if you wanted to eat fine food, you had to go to New York. And I don't know. You know, I am not from here. I've been in Philly for 17 years. I definitely feel like it's my home. I feel like in the last decade or two, it has gone through this transformation, and it's just an amazing place to do business. It's an amazing place to raise a family. It's got a small town charm to it that I feel like you just don't get, or you wouldn't expect in a city of this size.
Right.
And it's great to be a part of it. It's great to be able to innovate. And, you know, of course, opening a Zahav in New York would be like the most obvious thing in the world. But like, we made a lot of mistakes when we opened, and our community gave us a lot of passes to try to figure out what it is that we had to do. Mm. Getting national or international acclaim for a restaurant, an Israeli restaurant in Eastern Pennsylvania in the city, we needed this period of growth and this pass that we got from Philadelphia.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the fact that you came 17 years ago. You had started cooking in Israel. You came back to the United States. You went to culinary school in Florida, I believe. What did you expect to see from the culinary world here at that time? What did you see?
Well, I was literally on the way to New York. And I was going to go work, you know, it was like Le Cirque or Danielle or something like that. And I was here and ate, you know, I knew like Le Becfin. Mm-hmm. Was here, and the Four Seasons was, I think Jean-Marie Lacroix was like the chef there, and that was kind of a big deal, but I didn't know that there was like anything else. And I had dinner at Brasserie Perrier. I had bites at Susanna Fu, and then I ate a little bit at Striped Bass. I just didn't expect that level of sophistication at all. And Philly just seemed pragmatically speaking, it was just an easier place to live than New York. I mean, I was prepared to go live in the Bronx with seven other line cooks, you know, and live in a closet and make $10 an hour and then work at Le Cirque for a few years and then go to France and stage for 1 year and then come back and open a restaurant and that would be it. But, you know, that's just obviously not what happened.
Right.
And luckily I got stuck here. I worked at Straight Bass for a year and then I worked at Vetri for almost 3 years. And then my business partner, Steve Cook, who was a finance guy in New York, came to Philly, opened a restaurant, a BYOB in West Philly called Marigold Kitchen, mm-hmm. And then hired me to be the chef. And that was in 2005, and it's kind of how it went.
Yeah. I love the murmurs in the crowd when you mentioned Marigold Kitchen. This is
still an excellent restaurant. I haven't been there since we sold it because I feel like I would go in there and like ugly cry, but it was it was an amazing place. And that was the thing. I mean, Steve came back, had a few years of restaurant experience, bought this restaurant, and it was this 40-seat BYOB in West Philly and made it work, you know? Yeah. And you just don't have the luxury of doing that in a lot of huge cities.
Mm.
And it was so, I remember when I took the job there, it was like, the restaurant is 100 years old or something, and there are, at that time, there was a stipulation from the landlord that there were boarders that would live upstairs on the second floor and they had to stay there. So we'd be in the middle of dinner service and like a guy would come downstairs with like his bike and like come in with a dog and they would order pizza to the vestibule of the restaurant and walk it through the restaurant and take it upstairs. And that was the second floor. And on the third floor, it was like a haunted house. On the third floor, we had this water bath with an immersion circulator. And like, there was only one light that worked in this one room that had all these like doll heads and stuff. And
come on.
So there would be lamb shoulders circulator sous-vide upstairs for like 36 hours. There would be boarders with pets and bikes and pizza delivery on the second floor. And then we had a BYO on the first floor, you know? And it was really amazing, and it was really, I think, sort of indicative of the way that people think here. Like, you can be really creative here because the stakes are not as crazy. You don't need to raise $30 million or whatever to like open a new restaurant and try it out.
Yeah,
I think that people started to realize that it's a very easy city to live in, and it just became, there was this sort of energy and this growth and vibrancy, and in the spirit of celebrating the American city, people are now accepting of things. It became a lot less segregated and younger people started moving back. Hmm. Penn also, and I'm not sure when this happened, became the largest employer in Philadelphia. And so academia and medicine have been really charging a lot of the growth as well. And like, I live a block away from Zahav. I live four blocks away from my oldest son's public school and four blocks away from my son's preschool. Yeah. And you can just do that here.
Right.
It's not that difficult. It's amazing and it's beautiful. And from the restaurant perspective, there are people that were interested. This is not an unsophisticated town. And people are also pretty open about telling you what their constructive criticism is. the velocity in which you receive it. Especially amongst the Israeli population in your Israeli restaurant. Yeah, I was thinking about this too. I work usually like at the Pass, so Zav's an open kitchen. And we have like Israeli moms coming up to the Pass all the time telling me what I'm doing is wrong.
Yeah. You know,
and they love it. And they still stay and I kiss them on the cheek and all that. But they tell me all the time what sucks that I'm making for them.
And but in a world where, you know, all your customers are your neighbors, like they're like aunties. It's like, it's cool. Like that's what aunties for.
Right. They're like my family, you know? Yeah. Like even when they're giving you a compliment, it sounds like they're yelling at you. But I think it's wonderful. I think you should move to Philly, dude. I really do. I feel like that's like the responsibility of Philadelphians now too. It's like anybody that you know that lives in a different city, once they, especially if they like want to have a family, I'm like, you need to move back. That's like your, that's what happens, you know, because it is easy, because it's lovely here, because it is, there's so much history, there's so much progression, you know, and there's so much vibrancy, and you can walk down the street. And I think that whenever, and I hate to keep using New York, I love the city of New York. I love the island of Manhattan. It is unbelievable, but it is impossible to go through the Lincoln or Holland Tunnel without $1,000 just pouring out of your pocket, you know? And I'm like, I ate a freaking hot dog and I'm somehow down $1,200. I just don't know how it happens. Come and stay with us, Francis. You'll love it, dude. Come and hang with us. Come and stay. Come and walk through like Spruce Street, Harbor Park, or go to the Barnes, or run Kelly Drive. Do you run?
Do I look like I run?
Yes.
Well, thank you. I was just fishing my compliment right there.
And we'll run the Rocky Steps, and then we'll go to the beautiful museum directly behind the Rocky Steps. And we'll walk through Fairmount Park, and come and hang out for Fringe, the Fringe Festival, and feel and breathe the city for 1 week. And I'm telling you, you're going to want to move here.
This was not where I thought this was going to go.
Yeah. We were talking about,
I thought I was
going
to talk to you about
Greece,
like restaurants, and now all of a sudden I'm like, I'm talking to the world's best real estate agent.
I know. I have a great property for you. No, seriously.
So, okay, I'm ready for some apartment viewings. I'll see you later.
Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Solomonov.
Michael Solomonov obviously missed his calling as a realtor, but he gets by as the chef owner of Zahav, Federal Donuts, Rooster Soup Company, Goldie's, Dizengoff, and Abe Fisher. And we'll be back to talk with Chef Eli Culp on our show from WHYY in Philadelphia. So stick around. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters from APM. Our show today was taped in front of a live audience in Philadelphia, one of the great food cities of America, at WHYY. And we made the trip to learn what makes the Philly food scene so awesome. So we pulled together three of the city's most influential chefs, Zahav's Mike Solomonov, Angie Branca from Sauté Campar, and our next guest, Eli Culp. So Eli was new to Philadelphia when his chef career really took off. Like within 2 years, he was named a Best New Chef by Food & Wine magazine, and Bon Appetit called his high street the second hottest restaurant in the country, and he was ready to open a new place, 2 hours away in New York. But commuting home one night, the train he was on took a sharp turn at 100 miles an hour, and after that accident, Eli travels in a wheelchair and works to reinvent himself as a chef who no longer cooks in his kitchen. Here he is joining me on stage.
I don't know if you heard the clacking as Eli's wheelchair was coming up the ramp, but we were saying before, it's like, you're going on a roller coaster.
That's exactly.
So Eli, I actually know from New York City. Your last job before moving to Philadelphia was as the chef at truly one of the greatest restaurants I've ever been to. It's called Terrizi Italian Specialties. And if you don't know it, it was sort of talked about in the press a little bit as, the food was sort of described as being like, you know, fancied up Italian-American food. But I don't think that was exactly right. It had a lot of Italian-American signifiers. There was mozzarella, there was a portrait of Billy Joel and his, who's not Italian, but you know, right. Everyone loves that guy, but with his like boxing gloves, and there were like Stelladoro breadsticks on the wall, and it was in this tiny little deli.
But about 450 square feet.
It was the size of this stage. And, but what I was so amazed by, the food you were making there was, this idea of Italian-American food, and people think, well, that means chicken parmesan, and it means, you know, all these stereotypical dishes, but what was amazing to me was it showed that side of itself. But to me, it always felt like the inspiration was about the American part of Italian American. And it was a restaurant that really took its inspiration from America and the neighborhood it was in. It was in this neighborhood of Nolita, which is north of Little Italy, but very close to Chinatown and the Lower East Side, which was an incredible historic center of immigration in New York City, like waves and waves of Irish and German and Jewish immigrants from mm-hmm. Eastern Europe and Chinese and Dominican and communities have all sort of come through the Lower East Side. And so the dishes at Terezi were things like a salad of cucumbers that was, I think, fresh cucumbers and then like quarter sour pickles and half sour pickles and full sour pickles with a coriander vinaigrette. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I'm eating a Jewish pickle barrel.
Yeah.
Or I remember there was a cavatelli with like a spicy beef ragu. And there was a little bit of like maybe turmeric in the cavatelli. And I'm eating it. And it's, you know, an Italian dish. It's pasta. But I'm eating it. And I thought, oh my God, this is a Jamaican beef patty.
Yep.
And so the food was brilliant because you would go and you would have all these references to these other neighborhoods in the city. Clearly you had taken so much inspiration and research and kept filtering them through this other lens. So it was a little bit like of a Trump Loy effect. So you moved here to Philadelphia to become the chef of Fork Restaurant. Yeah. Did you take that same mentality and when you were cooking here, and what inspiration did you find when you got here? What were you making?
Yeah, so, you know, being a part of Terezi for those 2 years before I came down here was probably the most formative years as far as becoming, learning how to take a thought, giving it some sort of background, and then putting it on a plate. Mm-hmm. First thing I did when I got the job here in Philly was to just search, you know, what is Philadelphian cuisine? Because, of course, you have, you know, soft pretzels, and you have, you know, cheese steaks, and you have the whoopie pies, and, you know, and I started digging deeper, and I saw things that were really special, and started to think about how I could take this same spectrum that we were looking through at mm-hmm. the food at Terezi and applying it to Philadelphia.
Right.
You know, as I discovered more and more spending time down here, I think the main thing was just the amazing proximity to very passionate, very dedicated farmers and farm systems. You know, whether it was a technique, you know, taking a really great potato and taking the soil from that farm, putting aromatics with the soil, like, you know, cinnamon and garlic and ginger and cooking the potatoes in the dirt that came from the farm. You know, that would be another idea that came because the farmers are coming into your kitchen. You're able to talk with them directly.
Yeah.
You know, in New York, you would sort of have to go to the market on either Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Saturday, fight the crowds. If you can help it, try not to spend $10 on a cab, you know what I mean? Getting it back to the restaurant. And, you know, I realize here in Philadelphia, the relationship with the farmers and the farms was so much closer than what it was in New York.
Yeah.
And that was really an inspiration because then they started bringing me their ideas. What if I leave this product in the ground over the winter? You know, what is that going to do to the parsnip? What's that going to do to the Treviso? You know, these really amazing ideas would come out of these relationships with the farmers.
Yeah. So you had tremendous success quickly upon arrival within, I think, 2 years. You had opened High Street, which is fabulous. It was named a Bon Appetit Best New Restaurant, and you had plans to open a High Street in New York. You're on the rise in a tremendous way in terms of your career trajectory. You suffer a tremendous accident, and now you're in the mode of going from, you know, an ascending empire builder to having to think about whether or not you'll ever stand in the kitchen and cook again. You've spent a lot of time healing physically, emotionally, mentally, thinking a lot about what it now means to be a chef who doesn't have use of his body in the same way. But I also read an interview with you that said, you know, you really struggled in a serious way, and I'm sure some days are still like that. But that in November of 2016, you felt like you had a bit of a switch. Mm-hmm. What was that switch?
You know what? After about, that was about 18 months after the accident. You know, it's 6 months of rehab, inpatient rehab, from Philadelphia to New York to Atlanta, you know, trying to put yourself in the best position to recover the best you possibly can. You know, the acute stress that you're under in those first 6 months is not just me, but my family and everything else goes around with it was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. I remember when I first got back to New York, you know, we had signed, just rewind a little bit here, but, you know, we signed the lease for the New York restaurant in March of 2015. I got hurt 2.5 months later. Mm-hmm. So the restaurant was just starting the process of the construction and all that. Getting back to New York and this dream of mine, which was to have this restaurant in New York, I was very excited about it. I really saw the company going. And then when I got back, what it represented to me was loss now, because it was one thing, you know, I was working like crazy. I was going back and forth, you know, and I felt like my job almost killed me, literally. And, you know, the 18 months after getting hurt, it's really just about figuring out life again. You have to figure out how to do everything again, how you're going to live, how you're going to survive, you know, just getting everything lined up, rehab, you know, 3-4 days a week. You really don't have time to focus on anything but that.
Sure.
It was about 18 months after when, you know, something clicked in me. I don't know what was the real impetus for it, but I knew at that point I had to stop feeling sorry for myself. I really had to figure out how to get back in the mix and really how to survive on my own and try to make the most of it. When you have my son was 3.5 at the time, but you know, this kid, he's not going to wait around for you, you know? And I think that was probably, you know, the one thing that in me, I had to come to grasp with that and say, okay, I need to, it's not going to be what I thought it was going to be, but I can make the most out of it. And then getting back in the kitchen a little more, forcing myself back into the public, and a ton of therapy as well to go along with that. But,
sure. You
know, getting back into it was important. And you know, I feel like I'm succeeding in that now. So,
in what ways are you a better chef now than you were before your accident?
I think, you know, you have to adjust. You have to evolve. And obviously being in the kitchen day in and day out, you know, is not going to happen. It's not going to be like it was. As far as being better, it's hard to say exactly what I'm better at. I think for me, I have to be able to teach, explain, talk about food in a different way so that if I have an idea in my head of a dish or we're talking about something, I have to be very careful. I'm learning about ways to describe that dish so that it is... as close as I can get it to how I see it and I taste it in my head, which, you know, some successes, some not. So it's always a learning process.
Sure. It's interesting because I was reading, you know, your old colleague, Rich Terese, who said, you know, Eli's this huge dude. And he said that you could always feel how he could sense his own presence in a room. And I think that that's such a tremendously powerful thing when you have an awareness not just of yourself, but how your presence in a room influences a dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I think to be a great communicator, it's about making connections, and making connections is about empathy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's about recognizing what your presence does to and with the other people that you're talking to.
Absolutely.
So I think in his saying that, I thought, what you're describing, a focus now on communication rather than doing and having you see me do this thing and let me show you this thing, but let me talk with you.
Yeah.
Let me mentor you. It sounds like that's a thing that you can do, right? That's a thing that is a strength and a power of yours.
Absolutely. I think that's, you know, that's something that I still take a lot of pride in.
Yeah.
You know, I always ran my kitchens, you know, I use the analogy of a good sports team. You know, everybody has their role. Everybody has their job to do. And if everybody does that, we succeed together. And that's no different now. And, you know, for me to suggest that, you know, the satisfaction is the same, I think that would be, that wouldn't be genuine. I think there's still a lot of what was that I miss every day.
Sure.
And it's not, you know, by no means is it something that, I don't think anything will ever take that place. It's just about how I fill up the rest of the, you know, the time with other, inspirations and trying to, you know, those things are going to give my life the purpose that I had with food, being in the kitchen, leading the team to battle every day. You know, those are the areas where I'm now working on filling those in other ways.
Thank you so much, Chef.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Eli Culp.
Thank you, Eli.
Eli Culp is the chef partner of Fork and High Street on Market. And our final guest of the night was the Malaysian chef Angie Bronca. So she has a place called Sate Kampar, which is just a little place with some skewers of grilled meat, and oh, it happens to be a James Beard Award nominated restaurant. It's one of the hottest places in town, and she just radiates passion for her food, and she joined me on stage. Now, what you need to know is that we put little cups under everyone's seat in the audience, and we finally gave them permission to open them up and taste what was in them. This was a way of telling Angie's story, and off she went.
So let me tell you what this is that we are all tasting. This is called acar. It's a Malaysian style pickle. And it's something pretty dear to me. I'll tell you the story about this pickle. But it is, do you like it? Do you like the taste? It's delicious, right?
It's beautiful. So this is carrots and cucumbers.
And it's pickled traditional Chinese method with sambal tossed in it. It's a Yonya dish, and Yonya is it's a cross-cultural clan as a result of an intermarriage between the Chinese and the Malays. That, you know, this kind of stuff only exists in Malaysia, and it started from the 13th century, a long time ago. It's not something new, but we have a lot of cross-cultural intermarriage clans in Malaysia. So that's why in Malaysian cuisine, when you taste it, you always get these really complex flavors of all these different cultures, the Chinese, the Indians, and the Malays. And these were the people who were part of the Marco Polo spice trade, that the people who sailed from China to India to trade spice in that region. So a lot of the cuisine in Malaysia since the 13th century and the 14th century came about from this era of spice trading.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so complex, and the techniques that we use is so complex. But the funny story about this is in my family, my aunt, whom I call Kuma, because mm-hmm. I speak Cantonese, so Kuma is what I call my aunt, she was the best achat maker in the family. Everyone knows that. So every time we go back to Kuma's house, our one request is, Kuma, please make achat for all of us to eat, right? So when I opened a restaurant, I wanted to serve her achat. And in fact, in my menu, it's actually called Kuma's Achat, because it's her recipe. And I was here in the U.S. at that time, and I'll call my Guma. I said, Guma, can you please give me a recipe? And she says, yeah, sure, I'll give it to you. And she says, okay, you're going to use 1 kati of carrots.
A kati is like a measure
it's
of
a measurement,
weight. That's
right?
Like very the equivalent old. Of like 14 ounces or some. It's a unit of measurement.
Yeah, it's a measurement. It's a little bit less than a kilo. So kati is a little less than that. It goes 1 kati of carrots, 4 katis of cucumber, 1 bottle of vinegar. I go, okay, Guma, how big is that bottle of vinegar? And she goes, you know, that corner store, that guy who sells vinegar, you know where to get it from? I was like, okay, that's 1 bottle of vinegar. And here's the funniest thing. And she says, you go to the spice man and get a packet of rempah and some chilies. Like, okay, how big is that packet of rempah? Like, it's the same spice man. You know which one I always go to? Just asking for a packet. And here she's assuming that the same spice man would always be there blending the same rempah for her entire life using the same size packet forever.
Yeah.
And she's expecting that I should understand what that packet size is, right? And then she says, and 10 cents of turmeric.
So as a cookbook editor in my other life, like, this is giving me the sweats. Like, hearing, like, this, I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it does. So then I told my Kuma, I said, Kuma, I'm opening a restaurant. I think I need some metric measurements here. She goes, what is that? And 10 cents, I asked her, is it before inflation, after inflation? Like, which year? Yeah.
So you, before you were a restaurateur and a chef, you were an international business consultant.
Yes, I was.
Hence, you knew to ask her about the inflation on the 10 cents.
We'll be back in a minute with more from Chef Angie Branca. And later on, America's Test Kitchen weighs in on what should be Philadelphia's most famous sandwich. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're coming to you from Philadelphia today with an audience at public radio station WHYY. We were on a mission to talk to some of the people who make Philly such an amazing food town, and we're coming back into a conversation I'm having with Chef Angie Branca about her restaurant, Sauté Campar.
But so you spent many years in this corporate life.
Right.
You didn't intend on being a restaurateur. You didn't intend on being a chef. How'd you learn to cook?
I learned to cook in my grandma's kitchen and in my mom's kitchen.
In Malaysia?
In Malaysia. Specifically my grandma. My grandma lived in an era where, in her mind, the most important thing for her as her grandmother duty was to make sure that every woman can cook and can cook very well. Hmm. Because that was the only way that you can find a husband. Oh, that was the only way.
Old school, baby.
That was the era that she grew up in, right? And as soon as I could walk or maybe even crawl, I was already in the kitchen. So, you know, the day usually starts with making sauces and sambal. So peeling shallots was, I hate that. But it was my first job. So it was really amazing spending time with my grandma in the kitchen, because not only did she teach me the ingredients and the flavors and the combination of all the different techniques, the Chinese, the Malays, the Indian techniques, she had a whole different concept of how to plan a menu for every night.
Hmm.
And it's really funny. Every morning when my brother wakes up, the first thing my grandmother would ask us to do is stick your tongue out. Like, okay, what are you looking at, Grandma? I need to see what you're going to eat for dinner tonight.
Huh.
And
what does that mean?
So my grandma's idea of food is medicine. And, you know, the thing that you should be eating every day should be what your health needs and what your body needs. And for her to understand that was to look at the condition of our tongue, look at our eyes. She would usually question us, how do you feel? Do you feel hot? Do you feel cold? You know, stuff like that. But it was part of every day. My grandma just constantly teaching me different body conditions and how food relates to that, the yin and yang of every single ingredient. So not only did I learn the flavors, I had to learn the yin and yang of every ingredient.
Yeah.
And it stuck with me. And as I got older, and of course, when I got to the age when I had to take care of my grandmother and my mom, I would ask them to stick out their tongue. So I can understand what soup I should be making for them. That was how I learned. But it was a very different culinary education.
In a sense that your food and your well-being and your food and your health are so intertwined.
It is, yeah.
You left home. You left Malaysia. You, like I said before, you were in business consulting internationally. I think you went to school in Scotland and then you worked all around the world. You came to Philadelphia and you had this high-powered corporate career. You had a career that was, you know, professional. It was white collar. It was, I'm sure if your family is anything like my family, like, that was the sort of future that they wanted for their child.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Why did you open the restaurant?
Oh, God. It drove my family nuts. Maybe to drive my dad nuts. I really miss where I came from. I miss what I grew up with. There's something that being halfway around the world, with my family not here with me, that makes me want that more. Every single year, I just want that more. And after a while, it dawned on me that there were a few things that happened, right? I used to go back to Malaysia very often, and I would seek out the food and the memories that I remember as a kid. And every year I go back, I find that it's harder and harder to find that food. Mm. It's harder and harder to find those simple memories that I had. And here, of course, it's just not available. So the combination of those two things just made me decide, you know what, I'm just going to give myself some time, going to create this restaurant based on my memories, and just to preserve some of these. It's not just about serving food, but preserve the culture and the environment of how my particular cuisine would be enjoyed and the way I know it.
Hmm. So to create your own little world where it makes sense to stick out your tongue and decide what you want to eat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it was more than that. It was a lot of memories. I mean, like, okay, so satay, right? So my restaurant is Satay Kampar. So the feature is satay. And
little grilled
the
skewers.
Meat on skewers. And satay for me is pretty special because it's a celebration meal for my brother and I when we were little kids. Satay was something that, this is before Malaysia was westernized. This is like, you know, if you think back in the eras between the 1960s, 1970s, there wasn't even a McDonald's in Malaysia at that time. We didn't have a lot of access to Western food. So satay was the barbecue meat on skewers. Like, that was the best thing that you would get. So if my brother and I did really well in school and our parents asked us, well, what do you want as a reward? It would be satay.
And
it would be a lot of satays. So we would go out to this, you know, side street stall where we can now indulge in satay. And when I mean indulge in satay, it means my brother and I would have a competition. So how many sticks of satay we can gobble down that night.
Like Joey Chestnut style.
We would be just gobbling down satay so fast and then piling up the sticks next to us. And then at the end of the meal, we'll be counting the sticks that we ate, right? And in Malaysia, back those days, the satays were tiny pieces. The ones that I serve in a restaurant, by the way, is 2 times the size of what we would usually get in Malaysia. It's still small, but it's 2 times the size as what we would get in Malaysia.
Welcome to America.
Yeah. But they were like tiny little sticks. They're very well marinated meat. And the peanut sauce is just, you know, delicious. And my brother usually beats me all the time. I think his top would be like 60 sticks Like, we're like 50, maybe, you know. But that is our celebration meal. Yeah.
So you open a restaurant to train, and one day you'll go to your brother and be like, what's up?
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, but what made me really decide on satay is when I first came to the U.S., and I think many of you have tried satay. It's an appetizer. For me, it's not an appetizer. It's the dinner. It's the meal. It's, you know, you go for that. And it's so different here, the way you approach that. And that's why, you know, when I opened Satay Kampar, by that time, I've already lived in the U.S. for 17 years, or 15 years, right? So I understood that when food gets translated outside of the native country, it can change because it's so it's easy to create a recipe and to remake a recipe. Well, actually, it's not so easy because ingredients are very difficult to source here. But it's very difficult to serve a cuisine as well as to translate the culture of it, of enjoying it, and to translate the whole ambience with it.
Sure.
And so that's why I you know, open Satay Kampar to attempt to do that.
Yeah. It's one thing to make a recipe, but it's another thing to make a world around that recipe where that dish makes sense in its own way. But let me ask you a question, because most every other Malaysian restaurant I can think of, maybe in this country, serves, you know, all the greatest hits of Malaysian cooking from every region, plus pad thai and probably some sushi too.
Pad thai in the Malaysian menu bugs me so much.
It's like, you know,
you don't even get me started.
It's crazy. It's like, oh, like,
don't even get me started. Like, why would you go to the Malaysian restaurant and order pad thai?
Yeah, no, it's like it's going into Puerto Rico and being like, where are the tacos? Like, it's like not actually how that's supposed to work. But here's a question. How or why did you feel able to open something that, you know, people would think of as a Malaysian restaurant and not feel like you needed to do that or feel like you weren't going to have to fall into that trap of serving
pad thai?
Pad thai.
I'm not falling into the trap. But, you know, number one, I mean, I'm in Philadelphia. It's amazing to be able to open a restaurant with so much intent, and Philadelphians accept it. Philadelphians love it. It's where I am. I think it's a great thing. But the other thing is the fact that most Malaysian restaurateurs, when they're here opening a restaurant, the idea for that existence is survival. That was the one thing that they know how to do and they had to do to survive. So they're going to serve everything, hoping somebody will pick something. And if you don't like something, I'll make you a burger. Right? So it's the survival mentality for a lot of restaurateurs. I came from a different angle. I had a different privilege to be able to open a restaurant with intent, not defined by what you want to eat, but defined by what I want to tell you. And I think it's a big difference. And I think it's not just Malaysian restaurants. I think Asian restaurants in general in the past have opened because of survival. But now hopefully this the second generation, the third generation, and even restaurateurs like myself would be able to have a chance to open a restaurant where they intend to showcase an experience,
right,
which, you know, it's different.
Right. It's an opportunity for people to tell their own story.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Angie.
Thank you.
Angie Branca is the chef owner of Satay Kampar. And that was our live show. But obviously an evening with three guests doesn't begin to scratch the surface of the food world in Philly. So we spent the next day running around the city to talk to more people. And in the weeks to come, you'll hear us talk to and cook with people like the top chef star Silva Sanat. We'll make noodle bowls with the folks from Veg, which is one of the best vegan restaurants in the world. And you'll meet barbacoa master and immigration activist Cristina Martinez of El Compadre. That woman and her tacos were amazing. So there's lots more coming your way from our trip to Philly, but we're finishing up today with what some people argue is the real MVP of Philadelphia, the roast pork sandwich. I mean, when we got there, we went straight from the train to to the Reading Terminal Market for one that was like the size of my arm, and it was glorious. So our producer Sally Swift talked with Brian Roof of America's Test Kitchen about their research on what they diplomatically call Philly's other sandwich.
Hey Brian, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We are just back from a trip to Philly, and you know, that is one eating town. I had three people come up to me to tell me that the real sandwich of Philadelphia is not the Philly cheesesteak, but it is the roast pork sandwich. Are you in agreement about that?
Because
you guys have spent time there.
My whole time there, I only actually had one cheesesteak, and the rest of the time, roast pork sandwiches.
All right. Can you describe it for our listeners?
Yes. It's a heavily spiced, usually with thyme, rosemary, garlic, oregano, black and red peppers. The pork is shaved very thinly. It's a little bit wet from the braising liquid that they cook the pork in. A sharp provolone that really kind of knocks it out of the park. There's a little bit of greenery in the form of broccoli rabe, or in some places do braised spinach. And it's all encased in this crunchy on the outside, soft on the inside roll. And it's quite enjoyable.
Good bread in Philly. Wow. It's kind of amazing. It's no wonder sandwiches are so popular there. Now, there are two kind of premier places to get this sandwich in Philly, right?
Right. The first is that we visited was De Nick's Roast Pork over in Reading Terminal Market. And at first glance, you know, we walk into Reading Terminal Market, it's a massive, expansive market that's been there for over 120 years. And immediately I assume that it's a tourist destination and there's no sandwich worth its weight would be found in there. But you realize that after talking to everybody and getting recommendations from the locals that this market is as much ingrained in the local culture as it is in the tourism culture. So De Nick's has an incredible sandwich, and they top it with a little bit spicy, kind of bitter broccoli rabe. It's got a nice little crunch to it that really sets the sandwich apart.
Which is really, really wonderful, I thought. And then the second place to get it, is that?
That's over in South Philly at John's Roast Pork. And it's a completely different environment and completely different vibe. We walked in around lunchtime on a weekday, and the place was a noisy. It was noisy. Mm-hmm. It was vibrant. It was going on. But a lot of the yelling and the noise was coming from actually the crew that worked there, the kitchen crew, the cashiers, yelling back and forth, moving everybody through. Their sandwich is very similar in the terms of pork and the bread and the cheese, but they topped it with a braised spinach that was much more tender and kind of blended in with the sandwich. Still very good.
Boy, that divides the whole city. So you guys have taken on making the sandwich at home. Can you talk us through the recipe quickly?
Yeah. So we decided early on that we liked the broccoli rabe. So that's the direction we went. And that's just a simple saute of broccoli with an ample amount of garlic and a little bit of chili flake. The pork was a bit more of a challenge. We braised it after rubbing it with a combination of fennel, rosemary, thyme, and oregano, again, black and red peppers, and we threw a bunch of garlic into that braising liquid. We cooked it for about 3 hours. And then the real challenge after cooking it is being able to slice it very thinly. We don't have a deli slicer at home, so we had to chill the pork. And by chilling it, it really sets it up and makes it firm. And then once it's firm, you're able to slice it very thin with a slicing knife.
So, that's a really great idea because the meat being sliced that thinly makes it so tender and delicious.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's delicious. Now, do you have any advice on how to actually eat one of those sandwiches? Because truth be told, Francis and Erica, our assistant producer, and I went straight there when we got into Philadelphia. And Erica and I got seats at De Nick's. And Francis stood behind me. And we split the sandwich. And all of a sudden, I start feeling juice running down my back. He is eating behind me, and he's spilling juice running all the way down my back. He apologizes, but with a mouthful of sandwich. He didn't even stop eating, you know? Is there a way to deal with these sandwiches?
Well, Francis is a rookie. there's a maneuver in Philadelphia called the South Philly Dip. So you want to spread your legs about 2 feet apart, bend it about 30 degrees at the hips. Extend your arms outwards, your elbows outwards, so as not to get any of the drip running down your arm. And you lean over and you bite the sandwich. And preferably you're eating over a trash can or a kitchen sink or something.
We really needed you. Hey, Brian, thank you so much.
And thank you very much.
Brian Roof is the executive food editor of Cook's Country. And you can find the recipe for Philadelphia roast pork sandwiches at splendidtable.org. And that's our show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. And thank you this week for all of the help from our friends at WHYY and for the great trip to Philly. I can't wait to go back. And until next week,
eat well, drink well, and tip well. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And if you ever want more information on anything you hear here, head to splendidtable.org for all the details. Thanks again to everyone at WHYY and all the generous cooks and eaters in Philadelphia. Thank you for listening. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.